The House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome to the House Education Committee. If you have a cell phone with you today, please take it out of your pocket, purse, backpack, etc., and turn it all the way to off. Mm-hmm. Turning it to silent or vibrate doesn't do the trick because it creates interference. Thank you. Someone did a great job. And I know there are people listening on the internet who are interested in what's happening here, and we want to make sure that they can hear what's transpiring very clearly. We have two public hearings today. We're going to go in the order they are listed on the agenda. And so I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2944. Kevin.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, before you is 2944. Also in your packet is a Dash 2 amendment that does not supersede the entire bill but supplements it. The bill focuses on the creation of a presumption that parents act in the best interest of their child with request or with respect to hearings concerning determination of identification, evaluation, and IEPs and educational placement and programs free of public education, as well as if there are hearings with respect to that. There is also the presumption that's created by the amendment with respect to investigations, as well as situations in which development of an IEP is involved. That, again, the presumption is that a parent is the one who's acting in the best interest of the children. This also has an effective date. The existing effective date provides the presumptions first apply to actions on or after the effective date of the measure. And I believe there's some people who signed up. The list is right there.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to say your last name wrong, but Cynthia.
Oh, you did.
Thank you.
I'm accustomed to that. It's okay.
Thanks for coming. And our custom here, for the record, is to start your testimony by stating your name. You don't have to state your address, but just your name for the record is very helpful.
Okay.
Thanks.
Good afternoon. My name is Cynthia Mohuden, and I reside at 2681 Green Tree Road in Lake Oswego, Oregon. And Chair Gelser and members of the committee, thank you so much for taking the time to hold a hearing on this bill and give us the opportunity to tell you why we think this bill is a good idea and what we think it will accomplish. How much time do I have?
So I think when we talked about this yesterday, we talked about 45 minutes to an hour, and I wanted to ask you, you were going to take about 10 minutes
yes.
or so. Do you
yes.
want me to give you a cue when
that
you're close
great,
to the end of
I've
that time?
I've got my watch here, so I just want to make sure that I don't have 3 minutes
okay.
and then stop. Like, have
all right. I'll cue you at the 3 minute point. How's
I
that?
Appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I want to start out by providing a little bit of background on myself and how I arrived at the idea for this law and where we came today. Not that it's about me or my family, but just to give you an idea of where the inspiration came from. I've been an attorney since 1993. I am the chair of the Clackamas County Commission on Children and Families. I've also served as a contractor for DHS, serving the capacity of an OVRS hearings officer, and I'm also on the DHS child welfare mediation roster, and I've done mediated open adoptions in termination of parental rights cases. And so I've come to understand family law and the rights of children through my role as an attorney. And I never in a million years thought I would find myself in the position of advocating for my own child. But that is where I was last fall, and fall of 2007, and I'm continuing in that process. And the inspiration came from that process, but also from commentary to new federal regulations, which are not at issue before this committee today. But those federal regulations were new out of the U.S. Department of Education, which now allow a parent to revoke their consent for special education, whereas previously, once parents signed on, you got on the bus, and no matter where that bus took you, your family, and your child in the public education system, you were sort of stuck there. So the federal government now says you can opt out. But what that opt-out does is you unplug completely from services and everything. So there's no gray, there's no cherry-picking. It's in or out. And as that law, as that new regulation came down, I was reading the commentary to the federal regulations, which are cited in the materials at the very on the third page that I provided to you. And it referenced IDEA, and it's buried in the commentary, and I didn't pull all that out, but I cited the specific page numbers. It's, you know, in three columns, it's a giant document, as is everything from the federal government. talk about the act, IDEA, presuming that a parent acts in the best interest of their child. And for me, when the school district placed my child over my objection in a self-contained classroom in a manner that I felt was not consistent with IDEA or the least restrictive environment, I truly felt like the wind had been, I'd been kicked out in the stomach and I could barely breathe. And I'm thinking, here I am, smart, educated woman. If I'm feeling this helpless and powerless, what are other people that don't have the education, the experiences, and the financial resources that my family has, what are they going to do? So as I read through this commentary, I stumbled upon a letter, which I didn't submit for you because it wasn't written specifically to this House bill, but it is part of the record with the U.S. Department of Ed on this CFR, and it was written by a woman named Marianne Linden, who used to work for the U.S. Department of Ed. And as I was scrolling down the page, I was just fascinated by what this woman was saying and felt it was so consistent with my experience. And it wasn't until I got to the end and saw the signature line that this person was actually from my home state of Oregon. And things she said in this letter that inspired me to continue to move forward was, she cited Pierce versus Society of Sisters, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, which is cited for you by me as well in the materials. It states that parents have a fundamental right to direct the education of their children. And then she goes on to state in support of this regulation, it is not clear that this right and high duty should evaporate for parents whose children are diagnosed with disabilities, which is exactly what I felt had happened to my family. And as I've talked to more and more parents, that seems to be the theme over and over again. And I have friends who are attorneys also who have special needs children, and they feel the same way I did. They felt like they entered this twilight zone that was inconsistent with their own training and their own experience as fellow members of the bar and as parents in society. They're just like, why is this happening in this arena? It seems different from the rest of what they experience in society, if that makes sense for all of you. And a couple of them did submit written materials that are in your material. This letter is long, but one other thing that Ms. Linden states is establishing a hardline policy authorizing district personnel to override parents' choices is destructive of family-school relationships and ultimately harmful to the student. And it is exactly that reason why I'm here today. We are not creating a presumption, and there are some concerns that this may create some unintended consequences, that school districts will now attack parents in their personal lives. And that is a relevancy issue, meaning it's up to the administrative law judge or the investigator or whomever is in the decision-making role in the case of conflict or of the school district to focus on what is this child's disability, how does it impact their ability to be in a general ed classroom or not, what are their needs and services that they need to be successful in whatever school environment, and how do we do that in the least restrictive environment. So if parents have a few drinks on Friday night, that's not relevant to those questions. And the presumption, as I've cited in the materials, is just part of American jurisprudence. And for me as a family law attorney, it's just part of having your coffee in the morning with your breakfast. It's so basic to me that when you're in a situation where someone can just override your decision-making and not give you a reason why, personally, I'd rather someone tell me, why am I wrong? What's wrong with me? What am I not understanding? And I've asked that question, and I've contacted, I talked to psychologists, other school district personnel, and superintendents. I said, what am I not getting? And nobody could answer the question. They all looked at me in the eye and said, Cynthia, I'd fight this if I were you. And so that's what I've done. But not everyone can do that. And it's very difficult and very expensive, and it's not something I would wish on anyone. So my goal with this bill, and hopefully law as amended, and I do like the amendments because it applies across every arena, not just in due process, so I think that's key for reducing the conflict, is to eventually reduce conflict. And any change is going to have differences of opinion and how that's going to work, but I don't think being concerned about what I would characterize as bad actions. If a school district wants to attack a parent's person, that's a separate issue. And this law does not give them the license to do that, and nor should it. And I want to make that very clear. And it's not creating a presumption that doesn't already exist. My feeling is, for some reason, there's this cultural phenomenon of we know better than you by the public school system in the area of disabilities. And I don't know why that is, and I don't want to attack anyone personally about that, but that is something I feel has to change. Parents need a leg to stand on, and if someone like me can just feel completely When the day after they placed my child, I called up the school psychologist, and I just said to him, I said, I feel like my parental rights have been cut off at the knees, because that was the most articulate I could be that day. And I still, to this day, I think that's it. And what I want to do is give those parents their legs back and give them something to stand on. And is a parent right 100% of the time? No. We're all, you know, I don't know if all of you are parents. I know many of you on this committee are parents. I'm sure we've all made mistakes in our parenting. But that doesn't mean we're bad parents, and that doesn't mean we shouldn't have a stronger voice in directing the education of our children, especially families with children with disabilities, because those families face a higher level of what they need to do on a daily basis just to get by, and to have to come up against this kind of dispute with your school district is exhausting.
Cynthia, you're in your three-minute zone-ish.
I also want to finish off by saying I did experience the Oregon Department of Education complaint process, and I found it wholly lacking. Under IDEA, the Oregon Department of Ed is supposed to be our SEA, our state educational agency, in charge of oversight of the IDEA in this matter. And my experience is they do not take that job seriously. They are supposed to be the watchdog, and personally, my feeling about that is they are the lapdog. And that then makes the burden fall even more on the parents to try to hold districts accountable, to bring some accountability into the system. And what HB 2944, as amended, will do is send a simple, consistent value statement that's consistent with IDEA and American law that that's not okay, and we need to have IDEA properly functioning in our state. And unfortunately, as I know many of you know from the Oregon School of the Blind testimony, there's a lot of dysfunction, and the system is broken, and I hope this is not going to fix the whole system. I wish I could say that it would, but I think this will be a step in the right direction. I hope that you'll take it. And that is all I have for you today.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cynthia, maybe I misunderstood.
Sure.
A little bit ago, I thought I heard you say this is not creating a presumption that doesn't already exist.
Correct.
But on the first line, the measure summary says provides for creation of a presumption.
It doesn't exist in the ORSs. It exists in the case law that I've provided to you, and it exists in the commentary to the CFR.
Thank you.
So that's my clarification on that.
There are further questions. Representative Revlin.
As much a comment as a question.
Okay.
This is a big interest of me. The boys in my family all have learning disabilities, and including myself. And so I've dealt with this issue a lot. And as a high school principal, it was one of the tenets that I always talked to my special ed teachers when we're going to have our first meeting with this parent. Listen first and act second, because they've been with them a lot longer than you have and I have. And that at the end of the day, however, you have to make decisions, and you need to be clear and concise with parents as to where you think there are differences of that opinion, because I think we do get kids who are functioning, and I believe that every single child can improve, and I think sometimes we forget that, and that we need to keep working at it. But there are times when the disparity of what the parent wants to believe about the child and where they're actually performing is different, but we need to be able to show that to people.
Absolutely. I
so
agree
that
with that completely.
But I agree with the concept. I need to hear from other people, but it was a tenet, I think, that worked well for most people, because then you started having a working relationship with the parent.
Absolutely.
As opposed to an adversary, and we had enough of those anyway, so it's much easier to work with parents when you're trying to do the same thing. So I appreciate the opportunity to start having this conversation. So just a thank you.
Thank you.
There are other questions? I have one, and I'm looking around the room and not seeing any representatives at all from the Oregon Department of Education, the Coalition of Oregon School Administrators, the Oregon Education Association, the Oregon School Boards Association. Have they provided you any input or discussion about either this specific bill or the issue of accountability in special ed at all?
They haven't, and I also forgot to say, I have tried to address, I did start and go through the proper channels. I mean, I didn't just land at the legislator out of the blue. I did go through, I went to my school board, I talked to my superintendent, I told them I don't believe litigating about a child is ever the right thing to do, and you'll hear from your Supreme Court justices, your Court of Appeals, Judge Schumann is a big advocate of that issue. You know, and I begged them to work with me, and they just looked at me like, I don't, so I, anyway, so Locally, I haven't gotten any response on that issue, and on an organizational, no one has contacted me, and I am not permitted to speak to anyone at the Oregon Department of Education because of our pending litigation. All my communication has to go through the Department of Justice.
And I think this would be a comment to the committee. It strikes me that this is a bill. We've had a lot of testimony on the Oregon School for the Blind. As a parent of a kid in special ed, we certainly have experienced some of the same types of stories that we heard the other evening, and one of the challenges is the ability to engage people in the conversation about solving this problem, and I think it's very telling who's not in the room, who hasn't been in the room through the discussions that we've had, and I think that's a problem. I think we need all of our education partners to come together, and you can't just look away from special ed and say, it's too hard, we're not going to deal with it. We need to be starting to bring people in, hold them accountable, and say, we need you to partner with us at the table because we can't do it all on our own.
I agree completely, and I really want this bill, my hope is that it will pass, but if it doesn't, we will have accomplished something if we start a dialogue, because I really feel like it's sort of the taboo subject that no one wants to talk about, and it's a whole other world out there that I didn't know existed, even as a family law attorney with, I don't know, 15 years of experience or more, what I have at the time, and I just had never heard stories of these kids being shipped off these self-contained classrooms. I didn't know about it until it happened in my family, and then I found out, wait a second, I'm not alone. There's a lot of us out there, and you're going to hear from some other folks that have come to support this bill that, on an emotional level, feel exactly the same way I do, and it's, the issue with the Oregon School for the Blind, I think, how you define community is very subjective, and I think that was a real difficult issue for all of you to grapple with, and I think that issue of community transcends the entire disability spectrum. It's not limited to blind students or students with autism or learning disabilities or what have you. This is a cross-disability issue, and a lot of times I think these issues, you'll see conflict between what services or where are we going to focus our money and what are we going to do, and there's a lot of people trying to move puzzle pieces around on the board, and what I like about this bill is it's revenue neutral and it should apply across the board, and what I would hope is a very positive way for empowering parents. And a lot of parents that have been through this just feel so disempowered. They either they move out of district or they go to private school or they homeschool and they just don't know what to do. And I want to empower those people to stand up and be their own best advocates.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair,
yes,
comment. There's in the packet, I don't know where it came from, but Portland Public Schools in opposition.
Okay.
I don't know if they're here in the audience or not.
Chair Gelson, members of the committee, I believe the Portland Public Schools testimony was provided to us, I want to say, late this morning, approximately 11 o'clock. It's my understanding they do not intend to testify.
Okay. Well, I find this curious, and your comments were spot on, but I have to disagree with you on one area, and that is it's not just about disability kids, it's about all kids, and that this opposition is about protecting, quote, the system, not the children.
I agree completely.
And so I would, I just find that the whole issue of best, and you have it in quotes, best interest finding is not required by IDEA. Like, boy, talk about an anathema to education. So.
And
it's very curious that they're not. Nobody's in the room.
And I find it very curious because it's a significant bill. And if there's no one here that it's important enough to testify in opposition, that would suggest that this is a bill we should be moving.
I would think so.
All right. Thank you. The next
thank
folks
you.
Are Maya Williams, Anton Luru, and Martha Rennick.
Maya Williams didn't make it.
She did not. All right.
So I should put her in. I didn't have her on list.
Look who shows up.
She's on the list.
Did you want to testify? No. Okay. Come on up.
Yeah.
I've got Anton LaRue, Martha Short. Come on up.
Excuse me.
Thank you. And again, if you'll state your name for the record.
Isabel Sturman.
Great.
And I'm just going to read what I've written because I'm not very good at impromptu. Ladies and gentlemen of the panel, thanks very much for letting me speak to you today about this very important matter. My name is Isabel Sturman, and I'm the mother of two children with disabilities. Their common genetic disorder has left them mentally disabled and unable to speak. So I'm here to advocate on their behalf. I am a parent expert on IEPs. I've gone through the process 7 years for my daughter and 2 years for my son. I spent several countless hours on the internet educating myself on the IDEA, reviewing case law, and trying to understand the concept of least restrictive environment. I've read numerous books, spoken with experts at the ARC, Oregon PTI, and consulted with Oregon Department of Education, spoken with attorneys, and worked with mediators. I've learned just enough to get me into trouble. But the real eye-opening lesson I've learned is this. Parents have no real say in where their children will be placed. I'm going to repeat this. Parents have no real say in where their children will be placed. This is true despite the fact that it is widely acknowledged that parents are part of the IEP team. Their opinions should be taken into consideration. Yes, parents are able to share their opinions, offer their insights, but in any disagreement, the school administrators can and will override the will of the parents. This seems so contrary to me, to everything we do as parents in our daily lives to advocate for our children. I know my child and children better than any other individual on this earth. As I said, I am their voice. I know best how they learn. These statements are not meant to sound overbearing. These statements are meant to give you a brief description of decisions that I must make on their behalf. Quite recently, my husband and I were at an IEP team meeting for our son. This IEP meeting included the decision of placement for education. In that meeting, some team members sided with our decision on where our son's education should be served. However, the special education director of our school district had other plans. He noted that there was no consensus by the members of my son's IEP team. Then he made a decision to place my son in a setting not chosen by us. It should be noted that the placement chosen by the director is a placement that is cheapest for the district to provide. He admits fully that the placement costs the district nothing except the cost of transportation. There it was. The placement was chosen on mere cost. However, he will never admit this as the true reason for his decision. After calling the Oregon Department of Education and speaking with many people, I came away with two options: mediate or file a complaint. I asked the ODE employees about the law called the IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. I explained to them that several members of my son's team actually agreed with me about the placement. I was given the same answer by all ODE employees. A special education director's placement decision is final. Unless I pursue legal avenues, no matter if I or others on the team disagreed with him. I was shocked. How can I carry so much responsibility for my children, and how can someone who has never even seen my child decide what is best for them? What happened to my rights to be an equal member of the IEP team? Where was my voice? The same voice that decides everything else for my child was effectively and completely silenced. I now understand that a parent has an equal say in their child's education as long as the parent agrees with the school district. When there's a difference of opinion, the parent is assumed to be uneducated and uninformed. A parent, not an administrator, should decide what education is appropriate for their child. This is the spirit of IDEA. Please consider all that I have shared here with you today and understand that parents such as me are the best advocates for our children on many levels, and that includes decisions on educational placement. Once again, thank you for allowing me to share my personal story with you. I can only hope that you are able to change the system into one where parents can truly be made equal partners in the IEP process. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And you can pull the microphone closer to you.
I'm used to projecting. Thank you, Madam Chairperson, and members of the committee for allowing me to be here today. My name is Anton LaRue from Troutdale, Oregon. The young man behind me in the letterman's jacket is my son, Leland. He is the reason why I am here. 17 years ago, my son entered the school system. In accordance with the Individuals Disability Act, we all know this as IDEA's child find, it was determined that my son suffered from a severe learning disability, and we were notified by the school district that a special special team was going to be convened to determine what type of education my son was going to have. I remember this initial meeting quite fondly. Four specialists were present, two teachers, one principal, and a... I hate reading from remarks. And a learning specialist who began to tell my wife and I that they were the experts in educating my son and that he would be in good hands. At the time, not knowing much about the system and the procedures involved, I left this education to my son. However, after a year, I began to feel quite differently. Excuse me. When I began to question the IP goals and whether or not these goals were of any benefit, I remember the education specialist telling me, quote, "Mr. LaRue, your son may never learn to read and write as any normal child. If he wants to get his point across, he'll have to draw pictures or take pictures of the subject matter. Try to find a job in today's society drawing pictures and taking photographs on how he would like to communicate with the people around him." This was the day I declared war. This was the day that I went home, I pulled out books, I went to the library, I began to research on the internet everything I needed to know about what I needed to do for my son. I became an expert. I'm telling you, I felt like I went through law school when it came to idea. I wanted to make sure that my son wasn't going to be placed in a room and given menial, mundane tasks to do so he stays out of trouble and they give him something to do. He wasn't learning to read. He wasn't learning to write. He wasn't learning to do anything except how to be a good boy in school, quote unquote. When my wife and I demanded politely, of course, that we felt there was something that needed to be done more for my son, again, I was told, "Mr. LaRue, we know what is best for your child. We are the educators. We are the professionals." Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to understand, these women next to me, the folks behind me, we are the experts in our children. I know my son. I live with him 24/7, 365 days a year. I know what allows him to learn in a multisensory environment. He learned the alphabet through shaving cream on the bathroom wall. He learned the alphabet through the songs, A is for the antelope, B is for buffalo. He learned to sing it. Nobody at the school taught him this. His mother and I taught him this. Basically, Leland is my responsibility. My wife and I had the responsibility to make sure that we fought for his free, and the key word is appropriate, education. I basically, ladies and gentlemen, became the parent from hell. I made sure that any time there was an IEP meeting, I voiced my concerns in written form and sent it to them 2 weeks in advance. I sat next to the individual who made the decisions, especially when it came to placement and financial decisions. I ran the show, and rightfully so. It is my son. It is my responsibility. They are members of my team. And I've been very adamant about it for 17 years. So much so that if we had followed the school district's program, their plan, my son would be a shadow of what he is today. Today, he is a 4.0 student. Of the 9 classes that he has, only one of them now is modified. He is a straight A student. He is considered one of the top 5 tenors in the Pacific Northwest and, if I may say proudly, across the United States. And he has just come back from performing at the Carnegie Hall in New York City. This was a young man who was told he will never learn to read and write. But it was because of parents like myself who are adamant, who are actually getting in and doing the job. And we're not talking adversity here, folks. We're talking individuals who are saying, we are part of a team and we expect people to work with us. This law, in my opinion, allows parents who may not have our Constitution, who may not have the time that my wife and I put in to be able to provide this education for our son. This law gives a parent the key voice to be able to say what is correct, what is proper, what is right for their child. The Oregon Department of Education has failed miserably. In my conversations with the members of the ODE, they have been basically passive and non-willing to take on the district in the jobs that they are required to do. I have had to do it. I have had to sue the school district to force them to provide free and appropriate education for my son. I have had to work too hard. My wife has had to work too hard to be able to get what is rightfully my son's free and appropriate education, as well as the rest of the people in this room's free and appropriate education. I urge you to consider this bill, to forward this bill on, and I agree with your comments. Let's get the opposition, let's get the people who are involved in educating our children and make them part of this IEP team. Because this is what I see this team is. We're all part of an IET for the IEP for the kids in this room. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please, yes.
Hard act to follow.
I'm sorry.
My name's Martha Rennick. The idea that we know best for ourselves permeates our culture. When I go to my doctor, she gives me advice. She listens, but she listens to what I say first when I tell her how I feel. I'm not a doctor, yet it matters what I say because I know my body pretty well. You might say I know my body best. If I go to a lawyer for advice, it too comes only after listening to me because I know my facts probably best. In either case, I don't take their professional advice unthinkingly, unquestioningly. I may respond with questions, skepticism, and even doubt. It's a give-and-take situation. We're a team, and we have the same goal. Then why is it when I face teachers and principals and learning specialists in a classroom sitting around a little table on little chairs, I feel like I have to defer to them simply because they are the professionals and they are the educators? To call the participants in an IEP meeting a team borders on Orwellian. You can't imagine what it takes to go up against the team. It takes a great deal of bravery, time, and effort to oppose a decision. We don't all have what it takes, what he has. But if the language in this bill were the law, and if a parent were presumed to be acting in the best interest of her child, then the team has to theoretically listen to the parent at the very least. I can't tell you how many meetings I've been to, but I can say this about all of them. The decisions about the results of the meeting were made long before I came into the room. Imagine if your doctor did that. When I first read House Bill 2944, I was immediately struck by its simplicity. It was one of those light bulb moments when you say, aha, this is it, this is key, duh. But as I gradually internalized the words and what they meant, I started to feel guilty. And I was plagued by thoughts of, if only I had done this, if only in the second grade I had said this, if only, if only I had spoken up, my if onlys would fill a page. They would go on. My daughter's in the eighth grade now. In addition to my guilt, I feel and felt anger. And I wanted to go back in time, and I wanted to do it better this time for my daughter's sake. But we don't get to have do-overs, and my daughter doesn't get to become the reader that she might have been. I had intended today to tell you all about my daughter's story, our story, how I've been advocating for her since preschool, and all about her adoption from Kazakhstan and all her speech and language delays and all of that. But this morning, somewhere between the parking garage and my office, it struck me that today is about looking forward. One can hope that special ed in the state of Oregon will never be the same. Passage of House Bill 2944 will cause a shift in the special ed paradigm.
and I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. And colleagues, this bill hadn't yet been scheduled for a work session, but it has just been posted for Friday afternoon. We will hear this after 2 p.m. on Friday afternoon. It will be a work session. So today is the public hearing. And so if there are people out there listening in the world that wish, there's still more people that are on the list, but if you're in the hallway listening to this hearing and you wish to offer public testimony on it, this is the day to offer the public testimony.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Maurer.
The only thing that I am extremely disappointed is we don't get to hear Leland sing.
No. Italian, beautiful.
We should invite him back to do an opening ceremony on the floor.
I came back from state yesterday, so we finally made a state, so I'm looking forward to going again, so I'm really excited, and I just got,
Leland, do you want to come up to the mic so we can get you on the record? You have to state your name for the record, and that way we're compliant with all the laws since we're lawmakers and all.
Yeah, my name is Leland LaRue. but yeah, I just came back from New York, and I just got accepted into Bach, which is a very big thing for choir folks. And so I'm the only junior at my school, Reynolds High School, of course, who's going to be going. And so I'm really honored to go and look forward to this. You know, I'm following in my dad's footsteps. And so I've always, without him and everything, I probably would not be here today and everything, talking to you folks and also, singing. Because, he was the one who kind of brought me, into singing, I mean, he used to play the guitar for me when I was a little, baby and everything, and so I enjoyed it very much, and so, like I said, if it wasn't for him and his guitar and his music, I would not be here today, so, but other than that, yeah, I would have no problem singing for you guys.
We will follow up and invite you back. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
So our next panel is Peggy Morrell and Robert Keller and Christopher Adams. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Peggy Morrell. I have two children in my school district, and have been, for going on 10 years almost, I have served as a classroom volunteer, a committee volunteer, and also as an advocate for talented and gifted students. And all that means simply is that I believe that they're entitled to an education that's appropriate for their rate and level of learning, what parent doesn't. I have stood shoulder to shoulder with parents of special education children many, many times over similar issues that we've had in dealing with our school district, but most common and most often has been just the simple inability to be heard. I so appreciate Representative Maurer's comment that this was not just about children with disabilities or special education children. This is system-wide, and they count on it being system-wide because it's a coordinated approach that wears parents down. There were enough parents of the talented and gifted students who felt this way that we formed the nation's first TAG PTA, so that as a legal entity, we had to be dealt with, we had to be listened to, we at least had a voice on record. As a single parent of two, at that time, relatively young children, what a monumental waste of my time. Evening meetings, all the time it took to form a PTA so that I could have a voice is ludicrous. It's ludicrous. The most important part to me of House Bill 2944 is that it makes obvious, it puts the punctuation at the end of a sentence of something that should be a basic presumed right. I'm not saying that parents every time are correct on everything and every decision they make about their children, but I do believe that every time you sit down at the table with a school administrator, a teacher, a school district, that parents need to begin, the playing fields need to be level, that the parents are acting with the best interest of their child at the forefront. The process is too long, often requiring years and years of advocacy over a single issue to lead with your own ego. that will fizzle out way before you see the finish line. You can only be fueled by the passion for your child and the passion that they have what's right done for them in an educational setting. So the passage of House Bill 2944 makes that very basic presumption law. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Chair Gelzer and members of the committee. My name is Robert Keller, and I would like to echo, I mean, all of these comments about how the school district has ignored the parents' voice. I mean, I've been involved with the IEP process for 3 years now, and it's obvious that, you know, I come into a meeting, we have a discussion, and the personnel around the table are playing their parts like a well-rehearsed play that they figured out in their pre-meeting, and they had already made their decisions. And they pretended to listen to us, but never did they ever take us seriously or follow our direction on how we thought that our child should be handled. And in the complaint process, the ODE was even worse. The ODE took statements made by the school district that were poorly formed at best and had no evidence to back them up, and they took them as fact. Even when we made statements that contradict them and had documentation as to why it contradicted, you know, why they were wrong, they completely ignored our statements and still took the school district's position. And the ODE also, we had statements that the school district didn't even contest. They had no argument saying that we were wrong, and the ODE flat ignored our statements and went ahead and acted like they were never put in front of them and made their decision to the contrary. And it's been very frustrating to put in, you know, to advocate for my child and put in all the time and effort to do this and just to be flat ignored. You know, I even attended the ODE had a seminar for special education administrators, and it was shocking when I went into that room and sat there and listened to how the ODE presented to that group. I would have thought the ODE was trying to buy their business, almost. I mean, it looked like a pharmaceutical company talking to a bunch of doctors. You know, that was the atmosphere in the room. It was all turned around upside down and backwards. And there were, in the session that I sat through, there were six complaints that were talked about. Five of the six complaints that were talked about, the ODE had sided with the school district. And I'm not sure what usefulness that was when you're trying to, I would think they would be trying to show the school districts where mistakes were made and how to avoid them. All they did was talk about where they backed them up. And it was very frustrating for me to sit through that. And, you know, the Department of Education just does not have the parents or the children's interest in. They just listen to the school districts and rubber stamp whatever they do. So thank you for, I hope this bill will help change that, and thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel?
I do have a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, thank you for coming and telling your stories. It's, I'm very bothered by what you're saying. And I'm wondering, what the role of your local school boards has been in this. You have your elected representatives, and I would hope that they would be a conduit for your concerns. And I wonder if you could talk about that.
I have spent hours at school board meetings. I have met personally with two of my school board members, and you know they listened and have done absolutely nothing. There's no oversight there either. Mm-hmm.
I have to pretty much support that view. I have been the crazy lady at so many school board meetings, but I'm in great company. It's like every situation when more than one human being is in a room together. It's highly political. It's a very small town. We share the same school district. I feel like it's a rubber stamp for the school, for the superintendent, and it's very frustrating. And you get to the point where you know what you have to say to move on to the next step, but you know that nothing will be done. And the only way that we could get any kind of legitimacy was to form a PTA, because parents, I think, as a rule across the board, are all considered the crazy ladies.
And they tend to try to make you feel like you're alone. You're the only one that ever has objected to anything they've ever done, and they try to isolate you and humiliate you and shame you into not talking to anybody about it. And my wife and I decided, a year and a half ago that this wasn't right. We knew there were other people out there, and we were going to stand up. And it hasn't been easy, but I hope it gets us somewhere.
Well, thank you very much. If there aren't any other questions, we've had people that have joined us that would also like to testify. Great, thank you. So I'm going to call up Morgan Allen from the Department of Ed, Chuck Bennett from COSA, and Betty House from the American Association of University Women.
Good afternoon, Thanks. Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. I just wanted to come make a general comment about the bill. I am not a special education expert, but I talked to a few of our special ed folks at the department about the bill and sort of asked what their thoughts were generally on the bill. And I think there's a concern amongst school district folks and department folks that you would be unable to sort of reconcile the bill's presumption that the parent drives the placement, or the terminology best interest of the child is usually used in like child custody or welfare hearings, and it's a different standard when you're talking about very complicated federal special education laws. And under the IDEA federal law, the local education agency in Oregon school districts are the ones that are ultimately charged with making the educational placement decisions and have the authority to do that. So I think before this committee decided to move the bill, I would recommend that we get together with some special ed people from probably COSA and OSBA, maybe OEA, Department of Ed, maybe even DHS, and sort of see what are the ramifications related to the IDEA law, because sort of first look at the bill, our folks sort of raised that concern, is how do you balance the authority that IDEA federal law and statutes place with school districts to make the decision with the state law that sort of has a presumption that the parent is sort of driving the placement, or that sort of, maybe this is too strong, but what the parent wants is the right thing or the thing that should be done. So I think that's a real difficult legal question. Maybe we would want to even talk to legislative counsel about that, but that's about the extent of my sort of take first blush on the bill.
And Morgan, this bill has been posted for public hearing for a while. Has the department taken a formal position on the bill?
I've had no communication from the department about it. We're neutral on it, depending on sort of what other people have to say. It wouldn't have a real direct impact on the department and what we do. I think the impact would be felt at the district level, and it would, I think there's a chance that it would drastically change sort of the contested case hearings, and perhaps school districts would be on the hook for monetary awards and things like that if this presumption sort of changes, or the power shifts from the school district to the parent. So those are sort of the legal questions that we'd probably have to have COSA and OSBA help us understand how it would play out at their level.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Listening to the testimony, it's very moving. I immediately identified with a father who described the crazy parent syndrome reaction from school boards, having been a crazy parent over Title IX and a daughter that was really very athletic but wasn't offered opportunity. And so I sort of was... it's difficult to come up and discuss parent rights, having been through that and been through that with a school board and administration that was, from my perspective, not as forthcoming as I thought they should have been, very difficult to deal with. So it's easy to identify with that. And the difficulty that I find myself in is that I'm representing, in this case, school administrators. And school districts. But we've got to ask you, along with the department, to be very careful with this bill. It is, as I say, I describe my own attraction to the concept of parents knowing best what should be done for their children, despite funding, despite available programs, despite what may well be ultimately best for the child. And I guess what we're concerned about, number one, as Morgan described, the entire gamut of federal IDEA law, making sure that this doesn't absolutely distort Oregon's use of those funds and our way of dealing with it, our worry about its effect on due process hearings, whether you are establishing a brand new standard that we have untested. We don't know exactly what this means. I am no expert either on special education, and I take your question very seriously as to where are the experts. And I think it's a very fair question, and not one that I can frankly answer. And I apologize for not being able to answer it, but we have, we believe, a cadre of professional educators coupled with parents developing IEPs that we believe generally are in the best interests of children. I would suggest to you we're looking at thousands of children who have IEPs in the state. This is not a standing room only crowd. I would hope you would look at that and realize that there are going to be in any system, and I know you know this, in any system, there are going to be problems. I think we've heard some of them. I wish we had people here telling you about the successes, about the sensitive administrators, the sensitive special educators out there, the successful IEPs. I think the demonstration is that our special education system isn't in chaos. It isn't one of those that is brought forward as one that is in terrible condition. More commonly, what we tend to run into is it's a system that is underfunded by the federal government, that is difficult to administer because of its highly legalistic nature, and that we'd ask you to work with us on this issue and hopefully find something other than a complete change in the presumption of the presumption that is proposed in this bill that we hope would not completely undermine, we don't know if it would, but we hope would not completely undermine the authority of the district, but at the same time be as responsive as possible to the interests of parents. We had hoped that balance was in place now, but as you listen to the stories, clearly there are situations where folks feel like they have been rolled over, and that there's something wrong when that happens. And what we don't know is whether this bill is the right solution or something with a little more nuance to it is not a better way to go. And I wish I could give you a recommendation. I'm not expert enough to do that. So thank you.
I think just a comment. Something that's frustrating to me in this process, and you talked about it's not a standing room only. You're talking about families for whom the challenge of getting to a place like this
yeah.
is respite care. It's who is going to change the ostomy bag. It is who is going to take care of the autistic child that you can't find anyone to provide child care, and to families who have spent years and years fighting a system, and they simply don't have any energy left to go to a legislature. So I really appreciate these family members, mothers and fathers that have come forward and brought this. And I think we heard, again, in that Oregon School for the Blind testimony, those stories we heard were painful. And I've had a number of people say to me, gosh, that couldn't really have happened. And I know that those things are true. I know that, I mean, as the parent of a special education child myself, I've had a principal say to me when questioning a placement, you're the only one who thinks this way. Most parents are just grateful to have somebody to take the kid off their hands during the day. And some people see me as a stubborn, unyielding advocate. I don't know why. But if that was said to me while I was a sitting member of a school board, I just can't imagine that same story is not being repeated in school district after school district and IEP meeting after IEP meeting. And that's I commend the folks that have brought this bill, and I think it's time for the department, it's time for educational leaders to take this seriously, because families have waited too long for a solution, and what's at risk are our kids like Leland, where if we don't listen to the parents, if we don't meet the needs, you take a kid that could be extraordinarily successful and steal from them their opportunity to progress and be everything that they possibly can. I know that's not the outcome that anybody wants. There's a lot that's going on in school districts, but it's time for this to become a priority.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I just couldn't agree with you more, and that things are said that insensitivity surrounds this issue area, this whole process involving children and families is always troubling to us. I mean, I hate to hear these stories, and you know what my job is like. You've sat on this committee long enough, and it's like I never hear the good stuff, because there is, in fact, thousands of children who, as you described the variety of needs these children have, that are being served in school districts very successfully, and that's another reason people aren't here, nor in many cases the educators who are on the front line, because they're the ones back in the school district handling the issues you described. So I think we all need to be much more sensitive in these areas, and hopefully in the processes that we have developed at COSA in cooperation with the Department of Education, and God, I hate to mention it, but our sessions on special education, after listening to the gentleman's testimony, after his experience of watching them, hopefully we are building a consciousness that is as conducive as possible to incorporating the desires of parents along with the capabilities of districts to meet them and the state of the art in special education to provide the education that parents have an absolute right to expect for their children. So, again, I just in no way disagree with you. I couldn't agree more. And these kinds of hearings are, for all of us, I think, troubling, because the stories are very moving and of real concern. I hope we can help out in the future. So thank you.
And Representative Springer, you had a comment?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. As we discuss this bill, I guess I just want to caution us to be very careful and not make this a conversation about dollars and cents and what this will cost. And this bill, and I'm very aware of that, but I think we have more of a fundamental issue here than the cost issue. And this bill talks about the parent being the best suited person to advocate for their child. And I think we're talking two different issues here, and in my mind, and this is just me, I want to keep those very separate. I've sat through IEP meetings with my son. They went fine. I don't have a horror story. But maybe that's in part because, as I sat at the table with my son in that IEP meeting, I was also the school board chair.
Yeah. Madam.
So that's just, let me finish here, Chuck.
I'm sorry.
That's the reality of life. And had a lot of, I've said this just last week, had a lot of tools in my toolbox in that process. That wasn't about dollars and cents.
Yeah.
That was about being heard, and you shouldn't have to be the school board chair to be heard. Now, I am not making any disparaging comments about the district or my son's school. We had great relationships and still do. But let's keep these two things separate, because a lot of good, important issues die on the money hill, and this one shouldn't. It just shouldn't. This isn't about dollars and cents. It's about parents having the voice for the kids.
Representative Norman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Chuck, I think one of the things, my 22 years in Head Start, we have a model. It's in Code of Federal Regulations how Head Start respects parents and their parent involvement, and in fact, treat the parent as the primary educator of the child. So we do have that model in statute, and it works very well. And I will tell you this, the greatest advocates for Head Start are the parents. So I think that we can take encouragement from that model, and the other thing, and so this is a question I have for you, leading up to my question, is that there's a presumption that sometimes these IEPs become adversarial, and you've got two positions, and is it not possible that these can become opportunities for people to explore what's best for the child, and so that the parents have their say, the school has their say, and together as a team they come up with an answer.
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, I think you're describing the more common experience, that it is viewed as a team. What is unfortunate are, I mean, here we have two school board members with entirely different experiences. So there is, I think what happens out there is from district to district there can be disparities. One of the things we try to do in cooperation with ODE and others is to develop that kind of knowledge about the law, and I wish I were better versed in IDEA, but I'm just frankly not. I would hope that in the IDEA law there is some sort of clarification as to the role of the parent that presumes a special expertise. But we are trying, and it is an ongoing process as people come and go in this profession, as time changes, as sensitivity changes. We are trying to make sure that the kind of program and interaction you describe in Head Start is what is commonly found in all special education team meetings. And clearly, we're not at perfection yet, obviously, or we wouldn't have this hearing, and we wouldn't have had your experience. And it is not something that we're thrilled about, but it is something we will try to perfect. And I can assure you, we spend a great deal of time and a great deal of sincere energy trying to perfect this system and make sure that this kind of discussion is an exception rather than the rule. We're trying very hard. All I worry about with this kind of legislation is that we may, because of the compelling nature of this and the individual importance of it, we may create a distortion in the system that we really don't anticipate. And change its tenor and its tone where it is working. So, which is, I think, the vast majority of cases. So,
and I think
we're trying.
We're going to move on to bed. We've got one more witness on this bill, and then we have a whole other bill to hear too, and a room full of people that are looking forward to that. So, Betty, thank you, Chuck.
Thank you.
I'm Betty House with American Association of University Women, and I'm sort of the one you've been waiting to see her testify. I spent 25 years as a special ed teacher. I have a master's in special education, and I spent it here in Salem at Representative Thatcher's district at McNary High School. And I see the bill for two things. One is an attitude change, and I don't see how you can legislate an attitude change. And I think that's what is happening, is that the people are coming in to a meeting, and things are already set up, and they already have their minds made up. And that is a bad attitude. I wrote, the last year that I worked, I'm retired now, I wrote 125 IEPs. So in the process, you have to have the parents' input. The other thing is that the procedures don't seem to be being followed, because you don't go into an IEP meeting with all of those objectives written out. That's very clear in IDEA, that you're in there to talk with the parent and come up with a solution for the education of what objectives you want that child to reach during that year. And those are presented, and then the process of how that's going to take place, whether that's going to take place in a special classroom, whether it's going to take place in a regular classroom, whether the child's going to be by themselves, whether there's an aide going to be with the child, whether there's a peer tutor going to work with the child, or maybe the child is only coming into the ERC one period a day to catch up on his or her other work. But all of those things are the components that I don't hear from the people that testified coming into play. And that's very well, very precisely written out. So, you have the parents' consent for testing, and that's the basis to begin with as to why the child is or is not put on an IEP. And that has the deviation standards and so forth that you go by. And I think that probably what needs to be looked at is by the Department of Education as to exactly is what is going wrong here. Because it sounds to me like they're not following the procedures that are set up for an IEP meeting.
Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And our last person on this panel is Cheryl Gokin. I can't read my own handwriting.
Right there.
Welcome back.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with all of you again. I wrote my testimony regarding this House bill slightly different than what I gave you regarding the Oregon school issues. Mr. Dimbrough, I would like to answer your question about our school board involvement as it regarded to my situation. And so maybe after I read this, feel free to ask. Okay. Representative Gelzer and committee. I'm Cheryl Gakin from Lake Oswego. This is my testimony in support of House Bill HB 2944. As a parent of a child with multiple disabilities, and this is my son, I've left him out of his name out of the record, including severe vision impairment in Lake Oswego School District, and one who has served on local advisory committees for the past 10 years. I continue to have a vested interest in our educational system and the IEP process for all children in this state of Oregon. Without question, our system is broken and in need of quick repair. My child was successfully included and educated in our neighborhood school for 8 years. This success was in part to the working knowledge that my husband and I acquired in order to be the most thoughtful advocates possible for our son. We aligned ourselves with experts within the Portland metro area who continue to serve our son medically and educationally today. We spared our school district thousands of dollars in evaluations, always bringing to the IEP process the most updated and relevant information and data available on our child. Our IEP goals were always realistic, offered challenge and room for growth, and our son continues to this day to meet them with great progress. Our issues with our district continue to center on and around placement. And even though our son was being educated with his typical peers in our neighborhood school, making progress, Our administrators have continued to press to have his placement changed to a special classroom. Our child made it through the sixth grade, but unfortunately our district would not allow him to trek on with his peers into the junior high setting. And just for the record, in Lake Oswego we have two junior highs, and we've consistently over the years seen kids with special needs go to one side of the lake, and the other side is pretty much typical peer. That's changing, but slowly. For the past 2 years, our child has been placed across our community, leaving his entire support of friends to become a student of a life skills classroom with no, absolutely none, typical peers. He doesn't have any friends, and he is now ending 2 years at LO Junior High. Our son's placement is not serving him adequately, and the IDEA has guaranteed this. I just want to read it for the record. To the maximum extent appropriate, children with disabilities are educated with children who are non-disabled. And special classes, separate schooling, or the removal of children with disabilities from the regular educational environment occurs only if the nature or severity of the disability is such that education in regular classes with the use of supplementary aids and services cannot be achieved satisfactorily. And as I said to you, it was being achieved satisfactorily. There was no reason other than our director's opinion to move him. Our family will continue to debate in the IEP process with the advocacy of numerous professionals what placement is appropriate for our child. It is our belief that House Bill 2944 will restore our voice as parents and experts on our children's needs and in part set the stage for healing and restoration within the special education process. Now, I'd like to just let you know, our family's been through 5 special ed attorneys. You probably know them all. We spent $20,000 to keep Adam at our neighborhood school. That's what it cost us. And the last IEP, it was simply a wave of the wand. The director just said, I have the authority, and this is what we will do and where we will do it. And there was varied consensus on how this could work. I have met with former school board chair. She told me it should have never happened. Today, I can't recoup what's been lost. My boy sees his friends, you know, at the grocery store and within the community as we come and go. He can't get out and go find them. He's in a wheelchair. He's visually impaired. You know, the least restrictive environment is starting to look more and more like the Oregon School for the Blind. And it doesn't have to be that way. I don't want to see LO spend $125,000 to figure out how to get Adam down to Salem. I would like them to do what is appropriate. We've demonstrated it. Some of the finest doctors in the Portland metro area have spent tireless hours writing reports. They've been cross-examined on conference calls. Their reports have been challenged. These are educators that teach at the university level. You know, I found Cynthia, when I heard about her issue. And I decided that I, as a parent, was going to reach out to this attorney and mentor her. And I think it's made a huge difference. She understands the depth and the breadth. You know, and I'm a tired lady. I take care of an elderly mother that has brain damage, too. She's in my home. But I tell you, I'm not going to give up. I have too much invested. And I appreciate all of you just really wholeheartedly listening to us.
Cheryl, thank you. And after Representative Roblin, we're going to have to move on to the next.
Okay, I was just going to say a comment. And not only when they do that was your son denied that friendships, those friends were denied the opportunity. And
Mom and Dad lost their community, too.
And many of those kids grew because of the interaction. So I don't quite understand that one. But, you know,
well,
we have a situation, another bill here that has to do with handicapped people, and one of my students, who is also a representative, shared his story of mentoring a friend in a wheelchair who eventually passed away before he got out of high school, but in helping him circumnavigate around the community. They grew up together. They were part of the same deal. They
right.
cared about each other and gave each other insights into how the world could be better
right.
for both of them being there. And I feel for that particular
situation. You know, I have participated in our advisory committee to the school board and have tried to stay in there watching as our new delivery model has been crafted. Many of us know, you know, that it's a slippery slope and it's dangerous. Our continuum is being shored up. But we also see segregated environments now coming at such a rapid clip. It just feels like we are going back in time.
And really quickly, because we've got...
I mean, my other concern, you've been in there advocating for it. As a high school principal at times, my concern was the way the federal legislation was written and the way it kind of organized things, and it was really difficult even for the teachers that wanted to advocate differently to help the system.
Well, and I'll leave you
all the way down.
That's
wait,
true.
I mean, it was just driving me crazy.
We have specialists that are specifically the expert on our children in the different domains. They come and often do not speak. The director speaks for them. Much of our meetings are crafted before, and that is the truth. So it does feel like a sham. And, you know, we do what we can. Parents like me are finally realizing attorneys aren't going to get it done for us because we've got more powerful attorneys that our school districts are hiring. So that's not going to work. The best thing we can do is come here before you, do what Cynthia has done, and really just, you know, we the people, get in and make this work for us.
Thank you
very
much.
Welcome.
And to all the families that
yes.
have testified today, thank you so much. And I know that you represent many, many, many other families out there. You're champions for them.
Yep.
And thanks. We're going to keep
thank
working
you.
On this.
Okay.
All right. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2944 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2797. And if you're watching on TV in an overflow room, there are empty seats in this room, so you're welcome to come on over and be close to the action. Kevin.
Chair Gelson, members of the committee, I will be extraordinarily brief before it's 2797. Effectively, what this measure will do will repeal ORS 339035 regarding examination standards. We've taken the specific statute that is going to be most affected by this legislation and included it in your packets so that you can eyeball it as we're going along, and this is the provision that will be actually removed from the statute itself. It does declare an emergency, and the measure would become effective July 1st, 2009.
Kevin, thank you very much. And I think we have Senator Starr coming up from the hallway, so we'll have Kevin go and grab him while everybody grabs their seats. It's wonderful to see so many children in the hearing room. And here's Senator Starr. Please.
Thanks.
Welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity to testify this afternoon. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr. I have the privilege of representing Western Washington County in the Oregon Senate, and I'm pleased to be here to testify in support of House Bill 2797. For me, the issues surrounding this bill go back more than just a few years. Homeschool freedom and homeschool regulation in Oregon is something that I've worked on for all of my time as a legislator. And before I was a legislator, I was legislative staff and I worked on these issues. And I am passionate about homeschooling and the success that homeschool families enjoy academically and you know what homeschooling does to families and how it brings folks together. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill because of that. We have a long history, really, in Oregon of homeschooling and homeschool success, and it's an amazing success story. For a period of time in Oregon history, homeschool families were significantly regulated. They had to basically test every year. They had to you know, register with local school districts. They were always under the threat of having their homeschool children remanded to the public system. And to a certain extent, the leaders in the homeschool community had come to the legislature and kind of negotiated that kind of regulation. And what we had is we had a number of years wherein they lived under that regulation. And in that period of time, what we as policymakers saw is that these homeschool families and the kids that are homeschooled had tremendous academic success. And because of that, a few years back, we relaxed some of the regulations on homeschool families, basically to the point where they are today. And we did that, quite honestly, because of the unbelievable track record that has been established. I think that it's time that we move again to another step forward, and that's what House Bill 2797 really does, and it moves us to a point where we know that homeschool families and homeschool children have an unbelievable record of success. You've got moms and dads that instead of delegating the responsibility of educating their children to, you know, a private school or a parochial school or the public system, they take on that challenge themselves. They pour their heart, souls, lives into their children day in and day out in a remarkable fashion. It's a kind of dedication and sacrifice that is unique, I think, at least when you look at the general population. It's remarkable, and the success, I think, speaks for itself. I'm pleased to chief sponsor this House bill with Representative Barker. It's something that he and I have done a couple of sessions now. I don't want to take up any more of your time. You've got a committee full of folks that would love to have an opportunity to tell you their own personal stories and successes in homeschooling. I encourage you to listen intently. And I would implore you to take positive action on this bill. Move it forward. Let's continue the success, the great success that these moms and dads and children have had, and the kinds of things that they're bringing to our state of Oregon, I think, is phenomenal. And then one last point. You look at kind of the economic situation that we all know we're faced with in this state. And what you have in the individuals and the families that are sitting behind me are really significant savings, to a certain extent, to the overall education system. In that you have moms and dads that are continuing to pay their property taxes and their income taxes, and their children are being taught at home. And if those children had been or were going to the public schools, there would be additional costs there to the public system. So there is a savings overall to the state, I believe, based on the fact that you have moms and dads that are teaching their kids at home. With that, I don't want to take up any more time. I appreciate your allowing me to testify and say these few words on this bill, and I appreciate you having the hearing and listening to the folks that are going to testify after I leave. So I would answer a few questions if there was a desire, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. I think Representative Roblin had a brief question for you.
Just one question. I have a lot of friends back in Coos Bay who homeschool and do an exceptional job, so I understand that. How do we have evidence that they're doing an exceptional job?
We have evidence. This is you're a good legislator. we have evidence in a variety of ways. Obviously, we've got regular annualized testing,
and they've done exceptionally well.
That demonstrates they do exceptionally, and without question, you know, for the most part, heads and shoulders above their peers. We also, I mean, I don't know how many times you hear about the national geography bee or the spelling bees. Not every time, but lots of times, it's homeschool children that come out on top of those national competitions. And I don't think that's by accident. So that's another thing. Another, I think, proof that homeschool families and students are succeeding is the rates with which they're being recruited to universities today. That wasn't the case a few short years ago, but now you've got children that have gone through the homeschooling system that are being actually recruited to universities, and I think that you can hear some statistics about that. So there is. There is good data that basically demonstrates that these guys are doing a fantastic and phenomenal job, and I think they ought to be rewarded.
Thank you.
Paula?
with compulsory educational laws and the whole thing that this state has gone through since the 1920s and when people have to be in school and not, I and some of the evidence is about individual students, and I think that, and there's a lot of evidence that would show that. But if it hadn't been for state tests, I think people wouldn't know how well across the board it does. And I'm concerned when it's not there, some of that evidence will go away, and we'll get back in the situation that you were in the 1950s and 60s when they put all the other restrictions back on to this group of citizens and kids. And to never forget that when we did the compulsory attendance, along with it came that this is a property right that kids are giving up when they are not in the public school. It is a property right. So, and it's their property right. It goes through the parent, but it is the child's property right. And as a high school principal, if I was going to expel somebody, you have to recognize you're taking away a property right. It's like taking away someone's house. And I get really concerned when there's this whole population of people that don't necessarily have a voice over their property right. This is just me personally. That there isn't some way to continue to show that they're doing a great job. And I think the testing has shown that consistently.
There's no question. That's basically, we can point back to that period when we had very regular annualized testing, and then it basically proved the point. And I understand your point. You get away from that, and you don't have that evidence. That's why I appreciate the opportunity to come testify, because we have the opportunity to go back and look and say, here's our experience. And as policymakers, folks cycle through this process, and I don't know that any of you were here when we passed the bill when Governor Kitzhaber was governor and he signed it. But it's important to kind of refresh the memory and keep the issue alive. And it's kind of continuing education for legislators. I think it's helpful. So.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Representative Thatcher. And then after Representative Thatcher, we're going to move on to all the families that have come to testify.
Yeah, well, thank you, Madam Chair. I've been really quiet this committee.
You
so,
have.
However, I just thought it was kind of interesting to point out we just heard a bill on presuming that the parents kind of know what's best for their kids, and yet there are people who oppose this bill who presume the parents maybe don't know. I won't put words in their mouth, but it just seems like maybe they don't presume that parents would know what's best for their children. How would you overcome some statements from the opposition saying that without this accountability, these minimum testing requirements, that children would fall irretrievably through the cracks?
Well, at some rate, at some levels, there's other laws that we have that protect the health and welfare of children. And so if you have parents that are otherwise abusing their children, there's ways that we can deal with that. So that's one thing. The other is that that question comes with a kind of an underlying assumption that I think is just not correct, you've got moms and dads that are basically sacrificing their lives, pouring them into their children. And again, what we know historically is that it's the smallest sliver of minority of parents that aren't doing the right thing when they're homeschooling their children. And when you compare the populations, homeschooled children, private school educated children, public school children, there's no question that in every one of those situations there are children that are falling through the cracks. It's just a matter of who's responsible for it. I, for one, would trust the parents. And I believe that if a parent is willing to accept that responsibility and not delegate it to someone else, we ought to be cheering those parents, and we ought to be given all the tools that we possibly can. And so that would be my answer. And I would guess that you're going to be people behind me that will testify that even have a better answer than that one. So with that, I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So our first, and just so that you know, the next hearing starts in the same room in these very chairs in 26 minutes, and there are 7 people to testify. So as I call you up, just keep that in mind and know there's people coming behind you. Richard Cross, Lisa McQuistion, and Susan Farmer, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity. One word that just came to mention was the fact of accountability. I was kind of writing down different things everybody was saying in the last one. Accountability came up. I have a question. Where do you, as the government, get the authority for us to be accountable to you? The parents have the God-given right to instruct their children, not the government, not even your partnership, not even your input. We have that right given by God. My question is, where do you, in the arrogance of your committee or this government, come in and say, we want you to be accountable to us? If we were to base, I'm not here, and I speak for myself, so I'm not representing anyone here. They said to me, come here, be nice, I'm going to be nice, but I have to ask you this question, okay? One, if I were to bring facts, the public school system is an utter failure. For 50 years or more, you've been throwing money at a system that's producing criminals. We've got people in legislature and office going to prison, coming out of prison, or on the way to prison. You've got sex messaging and everything else. You've got drugs in schools. It's a failure. The public education system is an utter failure, and you are going to propose to regulate us. I'm a parent. I have my children. God gave me the right, and I do not have to be accountable to government, period, at any time. Where do you get the authority? Parents and children were first. Government came after by us, by the people. You serve us. We don't come to you and say, are we educating our children okay? Can you please? It's a mess. The public school system is going to tell me how to make my children, to raise my children? No, thank you. I'm not here to come to this committee and say, look, I can show you facts that we're better and we go to this thing and homeschoolers are good at this and homeschoolers, they'll do that. The rest of the people are here to do that. What I'm saying is we want our rights back, and the right is a God-given right. All right? As Moses said to Pharaoh, let the people go. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crash.
My name is Lisa McChristian, and thank you for hearing me. Representative Gelser, is that how you say your name?
Friends with Alka-Seltzer.
Okay. I always have to explain mine, too. McChristian. I feel very honored to be able to speak to you today, and it's nice to be able to be heard. When you're homeschooling, you're at home, and so sometimes you don't really feel heard. So it's very exciting to me that you're listening and that that you care about kids and you care about education. That's obvious from our last experience that you just went through for the last bill. I'd just like to share our experience with you. My boy's Patrick, and he's in fifth grade, and he's 10, and Sean, he's 13, and he's in seventh grade. And I would just like to share our education experience with you because it's varied. I was a professional teacher before I had children. I taught for 5 years, first grade. I graduated from school in Oregon with honors in education. And I vowed that I would never homeschool my children. And that was before I had children, and that was before I had sent them to school. And I did have experiences in a classroom. I have had experience with special ed kids, and mine are not, but I have a lot of background. My husband is very well educated. He has a master's in business administration from OSU with high honors. And for us, education is very important. We also wanted to share some of our values with our children as well. So we chose to send them to private school for the first, Sean went for the first 3 years, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grade. And my younger son, Patrick, went to private school for 1 year, pre-K. We had a wonderful experience there. And then we moved to the country, bought a farm, and realized that education was in a private school was no longer affordable to us. We had moved into a district with a very good reputation in education, and we felt like it was worth a try. So we did. We tried it for a year. We were planning on trying it for longer than a year, but within several months, our children began to regress. And we began to become very concerned and they were regressing academically and socially. Both of our children love to learn, and they are very intelligent, and they also really enjoy friendships. That was starting to suffer as well because of the other issues. And we, this mom who decided was never going to homeschool, my husband came to me and asked me to consider it. My children came to me, both of them, asked me to consider it. And I said I would consider it for their sake. After considering it and watching and meeting with school boards, meeting with teachers, going to committee meetings, going to school board meetings, going to community meetings, huge process, huge meetings, lots of discussion, came to the conclusion that we did need to try homeschooling. We tried homeschooling, and within months we realized it was a gem. And we had no idea. The people that we were meeting, the circles we were now operating in, these people were amazing to me.
Ms. Gishin, I'm going to ask you to summarize so that we can make sure we have time to hear everybody.
Excuse me. Yes, I will summarize. We have had a wonderful experience homeschooling. I do test my children every year. I do that so that I know what they're where they're at. I want to know where they're at. There may be an option to give a choice. There are probably many homeschool families out there that are testing their children even with this bill. If this bill is in place, it gives me a choice. It gives parents a choice. And I really value that as a parent, the choice to decide whether or not I do test my child, whether I turn it into the state. And so I value that choice. So that's why I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Susan Farmer. I'm a licensed teacher in the state of Oregon in preschool through grade 9. And in more recent years, my focus has been to obtain professional development in the area of learning disabilities, with particular focus in reading instruction and reading disorders such as dyslexia. I've also completed 15 hours of postgraduate special education courses. Since 1989, I have been a certified test administrator, providing homeschool children with achievement testing as currently required by the state of Oregon. I am also the parent of a child with multiple learning disabilities, which severely impact her learning. She is currently homeschooled. Some who testify today in person or in writing may speak in support regarding the proven track record of homeschool parents to provide their children with an appropriate education. In my 20-year experience in administering several hundred achievement tests to homeschool children, my personal observations confirm those statistics. So, I guess I need to ask, is there a reason that homeschool children should be tested? And is that reason or reasons sufficient to mandate testing of all homeschool children? Some believe that homeschool children should be monitored to ensure they are learning. I heard that question raised earlier. If that's the reason, then why are not private school children being required to be tested? Nobody's monitoring those. And the teachers in the private schools are not even required to have degrees or certification. So there, even though there is a person that is accountable, that the student is accountable to, they don't have a license. So there's not really a whole lot of difference with that child as there is with a homeschool parent that's teaching their child.
Ms. Farmer, I'm going to ask you to summarize because we have seven more people.
Okay. There are other reasons we could conjecture, but I want to address one specific reason that many use to suggest the need for monitoring the homeschooled students. The reason is to locate children with learning disabilities. And I must admit that in the 20 years I have been testing students, I have identified a few children who I believe have learning disabilities. But most of all, those parents did not need me to,
or my expertise to tell them that. The achievement test told them what they already knew. Additionally, the current homeschool testing law does not require testing by a teacher who has knowledge in the identification of learning disabilities. So having them monitored by a homeschool achievement test is not going to provide them with that information. If the score is low, there are multiple reasons for that. When a parent knows that their child is struggling, they want to find out why, and the achievement test will not provide them with that information. When parents are forced to spend...
Ms. Farmer, I'm really going to have to ask you to wrap up so that we can get everybody up.
Okay. Let's see. Well, I just want to let you know that when I, as a homeschool parent, sought this... sought the assistance of the public education system, I had to become an expert in my child's disabilities to get that. I went to the school and said, please provide my child with an appropriate education, and I had to go through a due process hearing without an attorney, and I was able to prove without an attorney that my school district did not provide my daughter with an appropriate education. In the course of that, they removed my child's disability rights, and now I'm actually in my second due process with the school district that in spite of two neuropsych reports, they claim that she is not eligible for special education. You've heard enough in the previous bill about special education needs. So if that is a reason why homeschoolers are needing to be tested, to monitor them so that the public schools can have more children that they don't know what to do with, it is not a reason. I urge you to please support House Bill 2797 as a homeschool test administrator. In the 20 years I've tested children, I do not see any reason why homeschooled families need to be tested. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Farmer. And our next panel is Roger Williams, Hannah, Barbara Smith, and Amy Grant. And so that we can get the last panel up, I'm just going to look at the clock. So by about 8 minutes till, so that gives you about 5 minutes for the four of you. Thank you. Which means just about a minute per person. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, we're the organizations that sponsored it, so I'm a little frustrated, but I understand it was an honest mistake.
Right, your name wasn't on the list,
yes.
So I had no idea. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Please.
Chair Gelser and the committee. I'm just going to make two of my points. Our students are being singled out for high-stakes testing. I'm asked, why should you not test and the public school students have to test? And the simple answer is that our students, if we flunk, we are forced out of our school into another school. When a public school student scores low, it's, let's hope that you do better next time. So there's a big disparity there in the use of the tests. The other one is that it's really easy. Let's put it this way. A lot of students drop out from public school, probably between 15% between grades, into grade 6 and the end of the school. That means that if you 10 are like typical sixth graders, one or two of you would drop out. So it's a big problem. Why are they allowed to drop out? If you look at the compulsory attendance law, it says they have to be there. And I have on the back of this a list that the ODE lists for, and I'm not going to read them all, that people put down for why they decide to drop out. So can you imagine what would happen if a home-educated student said, my school curriculum did not meet my needs, or my home life is dysfunctional, or I feel peer pressure not to achieve? Would that be accepted? No. This is releasing us from this double standard is reason enough to support this bill. We are asking for an equal application of the compulsory attendance law.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Hannah Jackson. I'm a junior at Willamette University, majoring in math. I have received the Holly Ford Scholarship as well as the Jory Haverkamp Prize in Mathematics, and I've been on the honor roll every semester I've been at Willamette. My parents chose to homeschool me after I spent 3 years in public education. They didn't feel like it was a good fit for me. I wasn't getting the education I needed. The education they gave me through homeschooling was not curriculum-based. It really encouraged me to follow my interests and to pursue a really non-traditional education. Along with that, they decided not to register me as a homeschooler. I was actually a member of an unregistered private school because they did not want me to have to go through standardized testing. They felt that it would it provided the opportunity to squash the love of learning that I was encouraged to pursue above all other things by discouraging me. They believe that children all learn at their own pace and that they should have an opportunity to be assessed at that same pace and not be held to these standard requirements. I do believe that testing has a place in education, and I feel that standardized testing is appropriate for a standardized education, but not necessarily for an individualized one like mine. I'll try and keep it brief. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Barbara Smythe, and I am affiliated with the Oregon Home Education Network. We're a statewide, inclusive, and extremely diverse homeschooling support and advocacy organization. I'd like to talk about the data that we have that shows that homeschooling works. And first, I'd like to just briefly tell you about a handful of kids that I happen to know who are junior high school kids. I'm a former junior high school teacher. Here in Oregon. I'm going to start with my 14-year-old son, who left last night for the first LEGO League Robotics World Championship in Atlanta with his team. They will be one of three teams representing Oregon at that competition. Out of nearly 400 middle school robotics teams who competed in Oregon this year by this program, which is administered by the Oregon University System, only three represent our state at postseason national or international competitions. And all three of those teams are comprised of homeschooled students. Last year, two of the three robotics championship teams were comprised of homeschoolers. One of those teams, by the way, is an all-girl team. They are reigning state co-champions. Oregon will also be represented by a homeschooled student at the National Spelling Bee this year. This is just another kid I happen to know. I didn't go out and search for this information. This is just, I looked around me and...
And Ms. Smythe, I'm going to ask you to summarize because okay. We're at that point. Thanks.
Science Bowl, Science Fair, National Invention Competition, Olympic athletes, Science Bowl champions, black belts. I could go on. But I won't go on with anecdotes because we want to talk about large groups of people because policy needs to focus on what's happening with groups, not individuals. So let's look at the data we have from the Oregon Department of Education, and the committee assistant has this information. What it shows is that homeschoolers perform about twice as well as the control group on nationally normed standardized tests. The data that's publicly available shows that for approximately 11,000 homeschooled students statewide who were tested in the 1998-99 school year, and this is the last year for which this data is publicly available, which means I can get it, it shows that about 10% of those students would be expected to score above the 95th percentile, but 24% of homeschooled students did so. 15% would be expected to score below the 15th percentile, but only 5% did so. And if you look at the sheet, I don't know if you have that, but you'll see that 50% of students in Oregon would be expected to score above the 50th percentile. That's why we call it 50th percentile, but 73% of homeschool students did score that. On a national level, an article in the Peabody Journal of Education reports that the average homeschooled student scores between the 80th and 87th percentile on average, depending on the subject area.
And Ms. Smythe, mm-hmm. There's still five more people, and we have 6 minutes.
Okay. We are one of the sponsoring organizations. Could I have maybe 30 more seconds?
Yes. And again, okay. I'm sorry. It's just I didn't have a list with you signed up.
Okay. So. We had a little communication glitch, apparently. Just to truly summarize, factors that do not appear, based on the research, to affect homeschool student performance. I'm not talking about students in any other context. Parental education level is a minimal factor. Family income is almost insignificant factor. Another factor which is relevant to this bill that does not predict higher achievement on SAT scores for homeschooled students is the level of regulation in this state. So students who are homeschooled in a state that has very minimal or no regulation of homeschooled students do not score better on their SATs than students in high regulation states. In summary, the research shows that homeschoolers are succeeding academically, that the educational requirements typically described as determinative of quality in a classroom teacher, such as a college degree or a teaching certificate, do not significantly improve student outcomes in the home education setting, that government regulation of homeschooling does not improve outcomes in the homeschool setting, and that government regulation of homeschooling, as Hannah has described, may in fact have a negative effect on student outcomes. So as you consider House Bill 2797, I hope that you will put on your skeptic hat in thinking about some of the cherished mythologies that we hold in our society about what education is supposed to look like. One of my favorite quotations is from Albert Einstein, who said, "We can't solve the problems that, or we cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we used when we created them." Please consider this bill not based on those mythologies or our 20th century thinking, but on the data and the facts. I welcome your questions, which I realize you probably don't have time to ask.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Amy Grant, and I actually helped draft this bill. I appreciate your consideration of the bill. Two points I wanted to respond to Representative Roblin. How do we have evidence that homeschoolers are doing a good job? This is my Exhibit A. All you have to do is look at any national data. I think we already heard the colleges are accepting homeschoolers at a higher rate. Stanford's acceptance rate for homeschoolers is twice as high as that for classroom school children. Every single school that my daughter applied to had specific mechanisms on their admissions website for how to apply if you're a homeschooler. Colleges love homeschoolers. We have a growing population of very civically engaged, well-adjusted, critical thinking young adults. My question is, how much longer do we have to continue to prove ourselves? I think we have proven ourselves. And why is the Department of Education no longer posting our test scores, which dramatically outshine classroom schools? Why don't they show it anymore? 1999 is the last year that they show it. So if they're not using that information, why are they still asking for it? In fact, the Northwest Regional ESD has already decided that it is an ineffective use of their resources to monitor homeschoolers, and they are no longer asking for tests. So they already acknowledge that they've got better ways to use their time and money than to go after homeschoolers who are doing a fabulous job. And I'm asking the state to follow their lead. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. I appreciate you hearing our bill.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for bringing it. I am so sorry that we have run out of time and the next committee is about to start. If you have written testimony, however, and you submit that to us, we will read every word of it. And I appreciate so much all of you that came today. And with that, I am closing the public hearing on House Bill 2797. And the House Committee on Education is adjourned.
That's all yours.
What happened? I didn't have anything.
No, I grabbed there.